Our sixth case this morning is number 06-1503, the United States against Cohen. Mr. Beavers.
May it please the court, Doug Beavers on behalf of Ms. Cohen. The government concedes in its brief that Seventh Circuit law does require that a perjury charge be based on statements answers to questions which were not fundamentally ambiguous. The two Seventh Circuit cases that have addressed, that have discussed this doctrine, Martiano and Jacek, have both said that this law applies. And in Jacek, this court did apply the doctrine. However, neither case explained in great detail what the actual definition of fundamentally ambiguous means. I think everyone knows what ambiguous means, but what is fundamentally ambiguous? And the problem is that in Martiano, the court granted reversal on other grounds, and in Jacek, the defendant's argument was nearly frivolous, attempting to argue that the question whether a person received any benefits from tickets he disposed of for people could really be interpreted to mean that he understood the question as meaning got money from actually the tickets themselves, not the people who were mentioned in the tickets. And that's really far-fetched. And I think because it was so far-fetched, this court didn't really get into what was fundamental ambiguous versus regular ambiguous. And the however, this court has the benefit of the six other federal circuits that have developed this fundamental ambiguity doctrine in depth, and they're basically all consistent in how they define it. The problem, the government did not respond to any of the other circuit arguments that I raised in my brief, and I think that that is a problem because this court's precedent has not had the chance that the other circuits have to really get into what is the dividing line as to what type of questions would be perjury, would be able to support a perjury conviction. And the government instead argues that that Ms. Cohen's interpretations were strained in at page 29. And I think that that is not the test that has been developed in the other circuits. It's not actually the test that was mentioned by this court in Martiano. In Martiano, this court discussed whether the fundamentally ambiguous doctrine applied where the if the defendant's interpretation would not apply. Fundamental ambiguity would not apply where the ambiguity was only created by interpretations which defied common sense or was created by warped sophistry. And the government does not argue that that's what our interpretation does.
I think, counsel, our cases stand for the proposition that, that ambiguity means contextual ambiguity, that you can't take a line of questioning out of its context and argue that the defendant's answers were literally true and therefore there's no perjury. It's got to be considered in the context of the case and in the context of the line of questioning. And isn't it true here that it was established that the ex-husband was paid his $9,000 in 1999 and that your client didn't get a payment in 2000, so that the only year that could have been under consideration here was 1998?
Well, no, Your Honor, because it's when you look at it in the context of the whole questioning and in the context of the lawyer's opening statements, his opening statements refer to his theory that there was that she was a trustee of the money, and his first going through the first 20 pages of that transcript, he makes an opening statement saying that she committed trustee defalcation or embezzlement by executing the assignment, which he contended had the effect of selling her interest in total, and that by doing that, that's what she did wrong in 1997, that when she received her money by an advance, she And he's correct, technically, that she did assign her all of her future rights, including his right to the money. And that action was what he argued was the problem. That's what he argued in his opening. He didn't argue ever, he never argued, she got the cash in hand and didn't turn it over. He never argued that. He argued 1997, early 1997, when she did the executed the assignment, that's the problem. And his questions all focused on that all the way through. And even after, on page 17 of Government's Exhibit 1, which I did not include in my appendix, five pages after the alleged perjury, her ex-husband's lawyer says that the judge asks him how he interprets the contract, and he says he interprets the original advance papers as selling his client's rights in total. And that is, in a technical sense, what happened, and it did have the rather inevitable effect of ultimately putting her ex-husband's money in risk because she took on too many debt obligations. And he continues to ask, as we go through all of the questions, he asks about 1997. He never asks when did you not pay, when did you get this money. He never even mentions that. And it is, I contend that there are two ways that that question could be interpreted as. First is continuing to ask about the transaction. He's just talked about it in his opening and in all questions up to that point, and then goes back to talking about the form of the assignment. His argument is about the form of the assignment. Her lawyer has made an opening statement saying that the facts are not in dispute and that this is just a legal argument about whether she actually was a trustee of his money. And if she was a trustee of his money, then that would have been a problem had she assigned all of the beneficiary's interests.
But she was being asked a line of questioning about whether she, in fact, received the payment from her creditor. And she answered, no, she didn't, when, in fact, she had.
Well, it depends on what time period she's talking about.
Well, that's why I excluded those other time periods.
Yeah, that was the 97 and 98, and she directly denied having received the $2,000, $9,000 check. And then the problem I have is, even if it was some confusion when the opposing counsel did questioning, the line of questioning that the court put to her, there's no way those questions were ambiguous. Very, very direct questions.
Except none of them mention what years. And it's asking, when did you take out the assignment? When did you take out the advance? And they're talking about she got $60,000. And the court, they're discussing the transaction. And it's the transaction that he's asking about.
But the two checks that she denied receiving were the checks, and there wasn't confusion about that. Those were the checks dated in 99 and 98. Those were the ones she denied receiving, correct?
No. They never ask any question about those 2 years, and it's so confusing. In fact, there was only one check missed. There was, contrary to what's in the indictment, there was only one check that she didn't turn over. She did actually receive the 1997 check and turned it over. 1998 she received and spent, and then it was garnished out of her other lottery money. So it is a very ambiguous fact pattern when you just ask, did you get that check? Well, technically she got money for that check. She got full money for that check in one way. But she didn't receive it as part of the deal. She didn't receive the $9,000, could be understood as the $9,000 per year, the $9,000 out of the first assignment, or the $9,000 for 97 or 98. But there's just too many checks to, when they ask about $9,000, to be, for it not to be ambiguous as to which year it was referred to. And it may be that the judge and the attorney asking were asking about different years and not understanding either.
Thank you, Mr. Beavers. We'll hear now from Mr. Harris.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Gregory Harris, and I represent the United States in this case, and I was also one of the trial lawyers below. As the Court has already pointed out, the whole issue involved in this case is context in terms of whether or not the defendant fraudulently lied about receiving two checks, a check in 1997 and a check in 1998. The defendant's claim is that she was confused about the questions. I think, as the Court has already pointed out, the questions were very straightforward and very clear. But if you look at the context of the questions, it's even clearer that the defendant could only have known that the checks the Court was inquiring about were for 1997 and 1998. Because as the Court's already pointed out, we're looking at checks that she would have received from 1997 to the year 2001. She testified at the trial in 2000, so obviously we're not talking about a check received in 2001. In 2000, her lottery check was garnished. She knew that. So obviously we're not talking about her receiving a check in the year 2000. Her check was garnished by Midland States Life Insurance Company. The previous year, in 1999, her check was garnished by her ex-husband. So we couldn't be talking about the check in 1999. There was no check that she received in 1999. The only years the questions could pertain to would be the years 1998 and 1997. And she clearly denied receiving those checks in 1997 and 1998. Now, that chronology, we submit, is sufficient evidence for a rational trier of fact to determine that there was sufficient evidence to show that the defendant lied about receiving those checks. But if there was any question at all left on whether or not she received those checks, those questions were answered when the defendant was interviewed by two agents from the FBI. The agents asked the defendant, had she received those checks to pass on to her ex-husband in the year 1997 and 1998? And the defendant said, no, I did not receive those checks. And in fact, it wasn't my responsibility to give those checks to my ex-husband. It was the responsibility of the lender. And we know that's not true because of the loan documents that were submitted showing that it was her it was the lender's duty to give her the $9,000 checks for her in turn to give to her ex-husband. So we know that that was not true. Further during the interview, at some point in the interview, the agents actually pulled out copies of the 1997 check and the 1998 check and showed her her endorsement on the back of the checks, saying, is this your endorsement? And she admitted, it's my endorsement. But I still didn't get the checks, and I didn't get the money from the checks. And the way she explained that was, I think at the time I entered into this loan, I must have pre-signed those checks and pre-endorsed those checks. We believe that the jury was entitled to consider that that would be a very unusual process, business process, to pre-sign checks, making them immediately negotiable, and that the jury was entitled to consider that in determining whether or not the defendant's story was plausible. The district court, listening to all of the evidence and listening to the defendant's testimony, found that the statements, the questions that were asked of the defendant at the bankruptcy trial were clear, were not ambiguous, were straightforward. Those are the terms that the district court used. And likewise, that her answers were clear, straightforward, and unambiguous. Viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, Your Honors, we believe that a rational trier of fact would conclude that the defendant committed perjury in this case. Finally, I would like to say that the district court judge, allowed the defendant to present her defense, instructed the jury on reasonable ambiguity, fundamental ambiguity, and on literally truth defense, so that the defendant was not deprived of getting her story out to the jury, that she misunderstood the questions asked, and the jury rejected that claim. We believe that based upon all the evidence, the district court's judgment should be affirmed. And if there are no further questions, I would return the balance of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Does Mr. Beavers have any time? No? Well, then the case will be taken under advisement with our thanks to both counsel for their fine presentations today. We have finished the call of the day, and therefore the court will rise until 9:30 tomorrow morning.